Blessed is the man from Rachmaninoff's Vespers. The choir of King's College, Cambridge, was conducted by Stephen Clebury. And so this edition of Sunday Morning draws to a close. I do hope you found it interesting, and thank you so much for listening. Next week, James is back again with his own custom-built selection. I'll be listening at home while raiding my own shelves for my next appointment with you, which will be in 2 weeks' time. In the meantime, enjoy your listening, and do join James next Sunday, same time, 9 o'clock here on Radio 3. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3, and my sincere thanks this morning to Neil Miners, who's looked after studio productions. Now it's midday and time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest this week is the artistic director of the Royal Shakespeare Company, Greg Doran.
Greg Doran is one of those lucky people who seem to have found the perfect niche in life. From the age of 13, when his mother first took him to the theatre in Stratford, Shakespeare has been his passion. As a boy, he dedicated himself to seeing every single Shakespeare play, sometimes managing to watch 3 Macbeths in a day. That sounds like serious obsession.
Yes, that was an extraordinary time at school. This was in Preston in Lancashire. I was brought up by the Jesuits at the Preston Catholic College. And we had a performance in the morning at the ABC on Fishergate of the Polanski Macbeth, which we were traipsed off to see. And then in the afternoon, it so happened that there was a touring production which came to our school. And then in the evening, there was yet another touring production of Macbeth which came to the Art Centre in Preston. And it was a space-age Macbeth with a very small cast. And all I really remember was Macduff receiving the news of his wife's death on a sort of intercom. But it was so, yes, I did actually see 3 in one day.
So there's no way for you that you can ever have enough Shakespeare?
He's somehow always refreshing. For me, as I've gone through life, he's appealed to me in different ways. For kids, I think what happens is you get entranced by stories of fairies and witches and shipwrecks and ghosts and battles. And then somehow as you grow up, the characters grab you or the language grabs you. And I think then perhaps it's the politics or the psychology. I haven't yet come to direct King Lear, though I've probably done now nearly two-thirds of the canon at Stratford, because I sort of don't feel ready for it yet. Do you know what I mean? That somehow you grow up with Shakespeare and he provides you with different things at different points in your life.
So, in a way, you couldn't have a more wonderful job than artistic director of our great National Shakespeare Company, a role you took on about a year ago.
It's a great joy, it's a great honour to follow some of the great people who've been in that job. I joined the Royal Shakespeare Company 26 years ago as an actor, and then moved on to being an assistant director and associate director, and yeah, now I've got the big job.
Your production of Richard II with David Tennant in the lead opens this week, and you've also announced you're directing Henry IV next year with your partner Anthony Sher as Falstaff. Unlike many directors, I don't think you came from a theatre background, or for that matter even an arts one. So what made you start listening to classical music when you were a boy?
My father used to collect sort of Reader's Digest box sets of music. I remember one came with a particularly rather beautiful set of music of great opera arias in famous old recordings. And he used to put on the bell song from Lakme and muse at just the astonishing virtuosity of this coloratura, great aria. And he would make us all listen to that. And I think it was his first inspiration. But my mother was a member of the local Women's Institute in Longton, and she did an elderly people's party every year, and there was a concert, and the Women's Institute would put on sort of popular music, and occasionally there would be a song that just moved me, and I guess that is this first song. It was the first time I heard this, sung by one of the daughters of the women of the Women's Institute of Longton called Diane Sidebottom. And she stood up on the stage of the concert in Marsh Lane, Longton, and she sang Kathleen Ferrier's Blow the Wind Southerly, and I thought it was the most astonishing, beautiful sound I'd ever heard.
Well, sadly, we've not got Madam Sidebottom's version, but we have got Kathleen Ferrier.
Blow the wind southerly, southerly, southerly. Blow the wind south o'er the bonny blue sea. Blow the wind southerly, southerly, southerly. Blow, bonny breeze, my lover to me. They told me last night there were ships in the offing, and I hurried down to the deep rolling sea. But my eye could not see it, wherever might be it, the bark that is bearing my lover to me. Blow the wind southerly, southerly, southerly. Blow, bonny breeze, o'er the bonny blue sea. Blow the wind southerly, southerly, southerly. Blow, bonny breeze, and bring him to me. Is it not sweet to hear the breeze singing, as lightly it comes o'er the deep rolling sea? But sweeter and dearer by far 'tis when bringing the bark of my true love in safety.
Isn't that gorgeous? She has such sort of simplicity. There's a great sincerity to her voice and a kind of, I guess, a kind of motherly quality. Is that the contralto voice, maybe? I think this was recorded just before she died in 1949.
Yeah, so it was recorded in 1949, yeah. Right. And amazing to think something unaccompanied and, as you say, so elegantly simple, actually outsold Vera Lynn and Frank Sinatra really? In its day.
Is that true?
Yeah.
How extraordinary. It has a sort of post-war melancholy to it, but at the same time, it's life-affirming. I don't know how that is achieved, but in this simple Northumbrian folk song.
I was thinking, as we were listening to that, about your love of Shakespeare, and it occurred to me that the musical equivalent, in a sense, is Mozart. Mm-hmm. That those two people had that kind of breadth of human experience and philosophy. And I'm wondering, was there a particular speech that sort of woke you up and that you thought, this is really what it's all about?
Well, I think, oddly enough, my first introduction was to Shakespeare was via music, in that these box sets my dad got, he got a 45 record of some of the incidental music from Midsummer Night's Dream by Mendelssohn. And in between the extracts, there were pieces from the play itself. This was an American recording, and the actress playing Puck, who sounded astonishingly like Mickey Mouse to me, I remember her twittering, I'll put a girdle round about the earth in 40 minutes. And I thought this was amazing. And my dad, who was a scientist, had pointed out to me that just before I was born, that Sputnik had travelled around the globe, you know, Russian satellite that sort of ignited the space race, which haunted my childhood. And I guess the fact that Sputnik could do it in an hour and a half and Puck could do it in 40 minutes was what kind of grabbed me. But it was then listening to Midsummer Night's Dream and listening to the poetry of Oberon's speech about I know a bank where the wild thyme blows. It was that incantatory language that just grabbed me. There's a lovely line that Frank McCourt says in Angela's Ashes when he's a child. a very sick child in hospital, and he gets to read Shakespeare, and there's nothing else to read. And he says, speaking Shakespeare was like having jewels in your mouth. And I thought that was a wonderful experience. And it's how I felt when I got to senior school in Preston, and we did a Shakespeare play every year. And somehow saying those words, having that language in your mouth, gave you sort of a sense of empowerment somehow, I think.
You were going to be an actor initially, weren't you? You started life as an actor.
I'd always done both, to be honest. I'd run my own. I managed to get a group of my friends at school to, in the summer holidays, put on Shakespeare plays. I would direct it and play the best part, frankly. I went to Bristol University to do English and drama, and then went on to the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School, still thinking that I was going to probably act. I think my ego wanted to act, certainly. I think directing was more in my DNA.
But was there a particular reason you decided to stop acting?
I know the moment, very specifically, I had joined the Royal Shakespeare Company at the age of about 26, and I was playing Octavius Caesar in Julius Caesar, and I forgot my lines one Wednesday matinee. And Roger Allam was playing Brutus, and as he moved downstage and I moved upstage, trying desperately to remember the lines, he gave me a look of such abject pity that I thought maybe I should give up. But I read a piece of Flaubert who says that most people end up in life doing what they do second best. And the trick was to know what you do first best. And at that point, I thought, no, I should stick with directing. That's what I... There are lots of very, very good actors, but the craft of directing is perhaps a rarer discipline.
Actors, particularly in Shakespeare, have a kind of shorthand that they refer to when they need to get out of a spot, don't they? They make up a kind of language.
Well, there's a lovely phrase, actually an Elizabethan phrase, that, bearing in mind that Shakespeare's actors, at the Globe, were getting through an astonishing number of plays, and with very little rehearsal time too. So there was a phrase, to fribble, which meant to improvise. You could fribble through. And I know actors who can fribble in iambic pentameter and get themselves out of any situation. I wasn't so good at fribbling.
I think the next music comes from a point in your life where there was a crisis, but it was not to do with fribbling.
It was to do with love. Ah, yes, music, moody food of us that trade in love, as Cleopatra says. When I was at university, I had fallen in love. I had came out, delighted to come out. And my first affair ended rather romantically in Paris. At that point, I didn't know, was I going to carry on? Where was my life going to lead, I guess? And I was wandering around in this melancholy state around the Latin Quarter, and went into a church behind the Sorbonne somewhere. And there was a concert of Baroque music being played, a fairly, as I remember, fairly pedestrian sort of music. I was sitting there at the back. And then suddenly this, what seemed like a little girl, stood up with a treble recorder and played this piece of Vivaldi. The first movement was joyous, and the largo that followed it was one of the most beautiful pieces of music I'd ever heard, and it just opened the floodgates. I found it opened my soul. I found it both devastating and ravishing at the same time.
Thank you. Well, actually, Greg Doran, that was the little girl you heard, because that was Michela Petri playing there the treble recorder with I Solisti Veneti, conducted by Claudio Scimone, in the Allegro and Largo from Vivaldi's Concerto for Sopranino Recorder in C major.
That can bring tears to my eyes very, very quickly and simply. It's just such a beautiful, virtuosic piece of music. What an astonishing way in which the musical line goes.
And like the Ferrier, a sort of purity of tone,
yes,
too.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And it grabs you almost immediately. Maybe I have a short attention span, and maybe my musical tastes accord with the job of getting music for plays and having to grab a theme very quickly because you've got a very short amount of it to play.
The next music is indeed for Shakespeare, but perhaps the composer is rather surprising.
Yes. Working my way through the canon, and I think I see my life like Prufrock and his teaspoons is measured out in Shakespeare plays. And so around about 1999, I came to Timon of Athens, and it was a play that I very much wanted to do, but it's a very unusual Shakespeare play. It has a kind of massive simplicity, and it's a huge parable in a way. And I was working out how to get this sense of its parable simplicity, if you like. And I discovered that quite a few composers have written music, rather oddly, for Timon of Athens. Purcell, at the end of the 17th century, and indeed Stephen Oliver, of course, wrote a two-act opera for the English National Opera just shortly before his death. But I then discovered that Duke Ellington had written music for Timon of Athens. It wasn't coming to Stratford in England, though apparently Duke Ellington did visit Anne Hathaway's cottage in 1933. But it was when he was playing at the jazz festival in Stratford, Ontario, and would sneak in to see the Shakespeare, and was sitting on the steps in the aisle watching Christopher Plummer and Zoe Caldwell do Antony and Cleopatra, that he became really enthralled by Shakespeare and wrote a suite of 12 pieces based on characters from Shakespeare, like Hank Sank for Henry V and Lady Mac for Lady Macbeth. And it was a few years after that that Stratford, Ontario itself got round to doing Timon of Athens and had the brainwave of inviting Ellington to write the incidental music for it. But the idea of putting Duke Ellington and jazz alongside Shakespeare seemed to me a really interesting one, because there's some way in which, I don't know, perhaps of all musical forms, jazz is closest to speech somehow, to the way that the brass can sneer at one point with scorn and then sob at another point. It seemed to me to be a very, very good fit with Timon of Athens. And so it was a real joy in discovering this odd conjunction of Ellington and Shakespeare.
Thank you.
False Friends, Duke Ellington's music for the banquet scene of Timon of Athens, composed in 1963 with Ian Harper playing alto sax and Christophe Chiasson playing violin. The conductor was Stanley Silverman. And by the way, all the details of the music in the programme are on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. One of the reasons I suspect that composers are almost happier writing incidental music than actually setting Shakespeare is that it is so jewel-encrusted that it doesn't leave the composer much to do.
I think you're right. Wouldn't it have been wonderful to have heard apparently Mozart at one point was going to write The Tempest? And Verdi, of course, was haunted all his life by King Lear. What would that have been like? But yes, that's different, isn't it, to writing an opera than writing incidental music. And there's very, very little time apart from the actual words themselves. And you know, one of the joys of my job as a director of Shakespeare is the number of composers that we work with, because one of the great things I think about seeing Shakespeare at Stratford is, you know, not just great design, terrific actors, wonderful costumes, etc., but is that it's live music. We have a live band. And
May that continue.
And long indeed. Well, certainly while I'm at the helm.
In fact, we're going to hear one of the composers you've worked a lot with, Paul Inglesby.
Yes, this will be our 10th Shakespeare play, Richard II. The first we did was Much Ado About Nothing, Shakespeare's great Battle of the Sexes comedy. And this is Julian Jensen, the tenor Julian Jensen, singing Sigh No More Ladies.
Sigh no more, ladies, sigh no more, men were deceivers ever. One foot in sea and one on shore, to one thing constant
It's rather odd, Sigh No More Ladies, coming from a man and being sung to men, isn't it? It should be really sung by Beatrice to her ladies, I think. And there's a lovely irony in that. So, yeah, Shakespeare's songs always have more to do than just entertain the audience at that point. There's always something thematic about the song at that point.
Paul Inglesby's music for Shakespeare's song Sigh No More Ladies, with Julian Jensen singing wonderfully the tenor line. Well, now we're going back 400 years for our next song.
Yes, this is a Cervantes poem which appears in Don Quixote. It's sung by Ferran Saval, the son of Jordi Saval.
Quite an important figure in music, because you really helped put early music on the map.
Indeed.
Jordi Saval.
Yeah, and I think we were listening to a lot of that music when we were putting together a play called Cardenio, which was our reimagining of Shakespeare's lost play. The Cardenio was written in 1613, we think, by Shakespeare and Fletcher, and was lost, but reappeared in the 18th century in an adaptation by Lewis Tybalt. I read it, read the Lewis Tybalt, read the original Cervantes, and had the idea that we could put together these two pieces and reimagine what Shakespeare's lost play might have been like. It's set in Spain, and therefore we listened to a lot of Jordi Savall. So one of the songs we chose was this song, which is a poem by Cervantes called Marinero Soy de Amor, and it tells the story of, it's basically telling the story of somebody lost in the sea of love. It references Palinurus, who was in book 6 of the Aeneid. When Aeneas goes down to the underworld, he sees his helmsman, who apparently has abandoned the ship but in fact has been lost overboard.
It begins, "Love's mariner, I sail the seas, and the fathomless depths I plough, with never a glimpse or hope of port, as I watch from the vessel's prow."
Marinero soy de amor, y en su piel hago profundo. De llegar a puerto alguno, marinero soy de amor, marinero soy de amor. Siguiendo voy a una estrella que desde lejos descubro, más bella y resplandeciente que cuantas vio Palinuro. Marinero soy de amor, marinero soy. No sé a dónde me guía, y así navego confuso. El alma mirarla atenta, cuidadosa y con descuido. Marinero soy de amor, marinero soy de amor, marinero soy de amor.
That's a wonderful sound. And in fact, haunting. It's Jordi Savall's son, isn't it?
It is. It's absolutely haunting. That I don't know whether it's a traditional Sephardic melody, perhaps, but there's something it has what the Portuguese call saudades, isn't it? It has duende, that sort of dark spirit of melancholy and loss. It's beautiful and beautifully sung, as you say.
Love's Mariner, a song by Cervantes from 1605, sung there by Ferran Saval. Well, presumably the words are by Cervantes. The music is probably anonymous, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right.
I think a folk tune. And actually now we're going to a Japanese folk song, a Hokkaido.
Yeah. This comes from working with Joji Hirota on a production of Macbeth at Stratford. And he was playing the drums for this production, composed by Adrian Lee. And Joji, in his own right, he's a fantastic drummer, taiko drummer. And we had taken the line from Macbeth of "A drama, drum, Macbeth doth come," as being an important element of the show. So the drumming was wonderful. And we indeed took the production to Japan. Joji's music in this particular track evokes a number of things for me. It evokes our first experience of working on Macbeth and then later on a production of Antony and Cleopatra together, but also of Japan. And Joji wrote this, he's taken it from a Hokkaido, old Hokkaido folk song. It's a tribute to his father after his father died. And again, it has, in the way that somehow music has the ability to do, to whisper to your soul, to whisper to your weary spirit. It creates that sense of loss, and it creates something nostalgic about, I think the story is about people travelling back to Hokkaido, the northern island of Japan, and as they cross the sea, they see the mountain on Hokkaido appear and feel they're coming home. And I think that's what this particular piece evokes.
It's a bit like Blow the Wind Southerly, in fact. It's a Japanese version.
Do you know, I hadn't thought of that, but I guess actually it is. There's a theme emerging here.
And there is the feeling of the haiku, the seagulls crying, "Suddenly I opened my eyes." Is that Hokkaido's mountain, the snow country? So cold. Please go safely. Please return soon.
Yamaka-o, angai.
Japanese folk song, Ashashi Oiwake, arranged by Joji Hirota. That's very much about homesickness, longing, yearning. And yet you strike me, Greg Doran, as being a very happy, positive person.
I feel very blessed, I guess, to be able to do the job I do, to be in the company of the people I work with, and to have Shakespeare as a passport through my life. So, yes, I do. I mean, why do I love hearing melancholy music? I recognise that a number of these pieces have really been quite sad and have slackened my tear ducts more than one occasion. But I suppose there's a lovely line that Jessica says in Merchant of Venice when she says, "I am never merry when I hear sweet music." And maybe the other side of that is true too.
But presumably, there must be quite a tough streak in you to run a company like that.
I guess so. I always say that directing is tyranny masquerading as democracy. And to some extent, that's true. What you have to do as a director and a director of Shakespeare, I guess, is the same as any other play, that you have to create an environment in which the actors can flourish, but you also have to edit the ideas that people have into a cogent whole. We're a fairly new breed, we directors. You know, we're only a century old, really. And I have great respect for the actors I work with and feel privileged to be in their company and in the company of those creative people. So I suspect that sense of being blessed is why this next piece has a kind of feeling for me. Bach's cantata, Ich habe genug, which would that one could have been present in, I presume this must have been in Bach's church, the Thomaskirche in Leipzig, on that Candlemas morning when this cantata was sung for the first time.
This does seem to plumb the depths of the human soul, this aria, I think.
There's no composer more devout than Bach, and yet his spirit seems to me to be so full of joy and life-affirming.
And rather, as with Kathleen Ferrier, we have that contralto voice, which adds another poignancy, I think.
Yes. I think the first time I heard this was Emma Kirkby singing a soprano version of this, and I suspect it was perhaps written for a bass or a baritone originally. But Janet Baker's voice, a voice I love, I had the privilege of meeting her once when I was working for I did the York Mystery Plays in the Millennium in the Minster, and she was the Chancellor of the University, I think, at that point, and I met her. And it was wonderful to be able to know the woman that produced this extraordinary voice. And I think it's partly, you know, I was brought up a Catholic. I lost my faith, or rather, as Sartre says, I think many of us have a God-shaped hole in our consciousness. I've probably filled it with Shakespeare, but Bach goes a good way towards describing the circumference of that hole. It's a glorious piece of music, isn't it? And I guess this is the moment on the Feast of the Purification of the Virgin when the Christ child is brought into the temple by the Virgin Mary and placed into the hands of St. Simeon, as I think Luke records it. And Simeon feels that his life has been fulfilled, that he is now content. And
there's also an air of resignation
as
well, isn't it?
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, it's both that resignation and that sense of acquiescence, of a completeness, I think.
I found it quite curious hearing that recording, because, of course, we so often hear it, as you say, with a baritone, Fischer Dieskau, for example, and with early music groups. And to hear that recording with Menuhin conducting the Bath Festival Orchestra and Janet Baker, it's strange how it must be like acting too. Fashions move on, you know, the sort of, you suddenly like going back to the declamatory way of speaking.
Yes. Well, fashions do move on, and I think that's a really important part of, certainly my job, is to recognise that those fashions do change.
We mentioned your relationship with Anthony Scher, which has blossomed for 30 years. And I think you celebrated a civil partnership as soon as it was possible. And in fact, you felt very strongly it was important to be absolutely open about that.
Yes, that's right. I mean, within my lifetime, you know, growing up in Preston, I really did think I was the only gay in the village. And things have changed very significantly in that time. And we've always made a point of talking about our relationship in a sort of quiet way. And now I notice there was a wonderful moment a couple of weeks ago when the Observer had a list of the 10 top power couples, and Tony and I were listed alongside Chairman and Madam Mao, Bill and Hillary Clinton, and Beyonce and Jay-Z. So I'm not sure what I'm doing in that company, but it's very nice to have reached that.
I wonder
height.
Whether Chairman and Madam Mao ever threw the crockery around when they were rehearsing.
Well, we did. At the beginning of our relationship, when we started working together, we hadn't worked out what the parameters were, and there was a moment when I did indeed throw a bit of crockery at my partner. But that was about our working relationship, really. I think we're very lucky to be together. And
but you're the right one to be the author of the crockery, because you do a lot of the cooking, don't you?
I do a lot of it, that's true. Often of a Sunday I'll be peeling the potatoes for a tomato bredie, which is a South African lamb stew, which I learnt to cook from Katie, who was the maid who had worked for the Scher family in Cape Town for 60 years, and Katie taught me how to make a proper tomato bredie. So I will be, on a Sunday, making this. Tony doesn't cook. He blames it on the fact that he's a privileged white South African who had people to do that for him when he grew up. And I did once ask him to boil some potatoes, and he let them disintegrate in the pan and then claimed they had self-mashed. so I don't let him bother.
Well, if you are happy about this, we'll get the recipe from you and put it on our Private Passions webpage.
Indeed.
And for the final music, this celebrates not just tomato bridie, but the whole feeling for South Africa.
It does.
Which, of course, for Anthony Scher, it's his homeland.
It is. He was born in Cape Town. And this is Miriam Makeba singing a Xhosa song called the Click Song. It's called the Click Song because apparently the English couldn't pronounce the Xhosa word, and neither can I, so I'm not going to try. But it is a traditional wedding song, and indeed, at our civil partnership, we had this song played. This is the Click Song by Miriam Makeba.
And I think it means literally knock, knock, beetle.
That's right. The knock, knock, beetle is an omen. It's a good omen on the road through life.
Greg Doran, many thanks.
Thank you.
In my native village in Johannesburg, there is a song that we always sing when a young girl gets married. It's called the Click Song by the English, because they cannot say Qongqothwane. Igqirha lendlela nguQongqothwane. Igqirha lendlela kuthwa nguQongqothwane. Igqirha lendlela hayo nguQongqothwane. Igqirha lendlela kuthwa nguQongqothwane. Hayo, sele qabele igqirha. Tantanam, Helen, Helen, his impandos cabal.
Caber and Friends with The Click Song, ending this edition of Private Passions. Michael Barclay's guest was the artistic director of the Royal Shakespeare Company, Greg Doran. And you can download that programme by going to the Private Passions page of the BBC Radio 3 website. Next Sunday at 12 midday, Michael's guest will be the author Roddy Doyle. Private Passions is produced by Elizabeth Burke, and it's a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3.
Monday night, Opera on 3, as part of a week of programmes celebrating Verdi 200 on BBC Radio 3. Jonas Kaufmann and Anya Harteros lead a spellbinding cast conducted by Antonio Papano in a performance one critic called an evening of pure vocal pleasure. Verdi's Don Carlo from the Royal Opera House. Tomorrow evening, at the earlier time of 6:15 on BBC Radio 3.
And Verdi is also the subject of Words and Music later this afternoon on Radio 3. Verdi, Conflict and Liberty is the title of the programme. Words and Music at 5:30 this afternoon. Very good afternoon to you from me, John Shea, with you this Sunday afternoon on BBC Radio 3. In a couple of minutes, Tchaikovsky's A Minor Piano Trio is the main work in our lunchtime concert. And then at 2 o'clock, a musical profile of the city of Prague in the early music show presented by Lucy Skeeping. That's in an hour from now. It's 1 o'clock now, time for the latest BBC News. A team of international experts has begun the process of destroying chemical weapons held by the Syrian government and the machinery used to create them. An official said members of the joint team from the UN and the Organisation for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons had left for a site where they were beginning verification and destruction. A source told the AFP news agency that the initial work would involve heavy vehicles running over and destroying warheads and chemical bombs. The American Secretary of State, John Kerry, has said raids by US special forces in Libya and Somalia demonstrate Washington's determination to hunt down suspected terrorists. Yesterday, US forces attacked a house in Somalia allegedly used by an al-Shabaab leader, hours before seizing an al-Qaeda leader in Libya. The Home Secretary, Theresa May, has said the Conservative MP Adam Afrié has got it wrong in his campaign for a referendum on Britain's membership of the EU to be held by the end of next year. David Cameron has promised to renegotiate the terms of Britain's membership and then hold a referendum after the next general election in 2015, but Mr Afrié said voters might think this was a delaying tactic. Reports from the Italian island of Lampedusa say 10 more bodies have been found following last week's sinking of a boat packed with African migrants. The search for the dead resumed this morning after a delay of 48 hours due to bad weather. The Iranian media say at least 4 people have been arrested for trying to sabotage a nuclear site. Iran's atomic energy chief said the alleged saboteurs had been under surveillance for some time and had been caught red-handed, but he gave no details of their nationality. The Olympic flame has arrived in Moscow, ahead of next year's Winter Games in Sochi. Tomorrow, it'll begin a marathon journey across Russia, the longest torch relay in Olympic history. The torch will travel to the bottom of Lake Baikal and to the top of Europe's highest mountain, Elbrus, and it will even be flown up to the International Space Station. And the weather here on Earth, most areas of the UK will be staying fine with some warm sunshine. That's the news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at almost 3 minutes past one. And so to today's lunchtime concerts, and this one was given at the 2009 City of London Festival. It features three former members of the Radio 3 New Generation Artist Scheme, the Israeli pianist Shai Wozner, one of Scandinavia's leading young cellists, the Dane Andreas Brantelid, and the violinist, our very own Jennifer Pike. They came together at London's St Anne and St Agnes Church in Gresham Street in the summer of 2009 to play Tchaikovsky's Piano Trio. Like so many of Tchaikovsky's works, it's a piece that comes with a fair amount of emotional baggage attached to it. The composer dedicated it to the memory of his mentor and friend Nikolai Rubinstein, who'd caused a temporary rift in their relationship when he dismissed Tchaikovsky's first piano concerto as worthless and unplayable. But that rift was healed, and the trio's second movement variations are testament to Rubinstein's love of folk song, testament too to Tchaikovsky's feelings of loss for his friend, who died in 1881. There are just two movements to the trio, both on a grand scale. The second one is that set of variations, and this first one Tchaikovsky called an elegiac piece.